Strauss and Howe in The Fourth Turning describe millennials as a hero generation, one usually coming of age during a time of crisis. Hero generations go on to resolve that crisis and are defined by that for the rest of their lives. Despite the heavy criticism millennials have received, most are no longer considered snowflakes or failures to launch. In fact, most are well into adulthood with taxes to pay and families to support. While it may be unclear what their exact generational crisis is to resolve, millennials have successfully advocated for racial and gender inclusivity and diversity in society, in the workplace, and in the military, and have expanded their reach globally on many social and environmental issues. Shannon Razadin, a millennial military spouse, was one of the co-founders of the nonprofit Military Family Advisory Network, or MFAN, which organized the survey that brought qualitative and quantitative data to the housing crisis in 2019. Validating the emotions and concerns of thousands, she, along with many others, made it safe for families to finally feel seen after decades of housing concerns. I wanted to bring Shannon on to share more about her motivations before and during those years, as well as her own first impressions of the military community when she came in. I'm Corey Weathers. You're listening to Military Culture Shift, a limited series podcast on the impact of war, money, and generational perspective on morale, retention, and leadership. With me is Shannon Razadin. Shannon, you are the president and also the executive director of Military Family Advisory Network. We call it MFAN. If you recognize her name, Shannon was mentioned at the end of the chapter on millennials, talking about millennial leadership, but also what millennials can do and what they have done in the force. And Shannon, you are just an amazing example of that. Thank you so much for joining in on the conversation and expanding it.
Thank you so much, Corey, for having me. I'm thrilled.
Yes. And so we met a few years ago. We were just talking about that. And when I first met you, it wasn't that you had just launched MFAN, but I do believe it was one of the first moments where you were planning revealing research. And so MFAN is a lot about doing research and is leading the way on especially food insecurity right now. But when I was talking with you, we were talking about food insecurity. But in the book, we talk about some of the work that MFAN has done in revealing the mold crisis as well. So I think, first of all, thank you for what you guys have done. But what I really would love to do to start is for you to share a little bit of your background and what led to the beginning of MFAN and the great research that you guys are doing.
Absolutely. So my story is one of really accidental opportunities that came to a place where I had the incredible fortune of starting this organization. So my background, I'm a Spanish major in college, was going to be a teacher, did one day of student teaching, figured out it was not for me. Ended up going to grad school, started my master's in clinical mental health counseling. And then I was offered a job at George Washington University to lead their first ever National Day of Service. I did the service event. The First Lady Michelle Obama participated and all
no pressure.
No pressure. And so all of a sudden I had this exposure to a different world. And this first day of service was focused on serving those who had served us. And so really giving back to the military and veteran community. And at that point, I was a single 22, 23-year-old. I had no connection to the military and found myself really caring a lot about this space, volunteering with organizations like TAPS, volunteering at a retirement home for Vietnam and World War II veterans, and just truly trying to figure out like how can I get more involved in this space. From there, I was recruited to join a PR firm, a communications firm in the DC area, and they were leading some of the work around Veterans Crisis Line, and that is what really interested me in joining them and really kind of figuring out how I could support this community and also, you know, build a career. And really, I had the incredible opportunity of working under Rosemary Williams, who was also working at that firm. And she had this idea for creating a group of military spouses who could be an ear to the ground to make sure that people are really connected to the lived experiences, but also an opportunity for peer-to-peer communication and outreach so that people are aware of and connected to the resources that are out there. Because oftentimes it's not a question of if the resource is there, it's if people are aware. And who do people trust more? They trust, you know, people who are living, breathing, eating, sleeping this life alongside of them. So this was 10 years ago, and Rosemary was soon after that scooped up to be the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military, Community, and Family Policy. And my bosses at this firm really said to me, at this point I was engaged to my now husband, Alex A. Razadin, who was in the Navy. I was the only one really with any loose military connection. And so they gave me the opportunity and said, you know, Shannon, if you want to run with this, we'll support you, go for it. And so that was when the first advisory board came together. And there were a lot of people who have been incredibly influential in my life, and have done amazing things to support this community around a table together and really fleshing out who are we in this space, where can we give back, and where can we lean in? And to do that and really set up the framework, we wanted to understand the lived experiences more. And so we conducted our first survey. And doing that research really not only helped us uncover the issues, but also helped us understand, you know, the why, the so what, and the now what component. And because we take the time to hear from people in their own words through our research, it has allowed us the opportunity to uncover some of the challenges that haven't really made it to mainstream yet. So things like the issues of privatized housing back in 2019, and then more recently, the work that we have done in food insecurity.
So I was going to ask, first of all, why research? You sound like, you know, you really started off with this. You mentioned clinical counseling background, your love and service for people, your heart for the community. What was it about research? Because there's so many that have started nonprofits or who want to start nonprofits doing different kinds of programming and services, but why research?
So we wanted to have the needs guide where we go, right? And really take a data-informed approach to everything that we do. There are a lot of great organizations out there. I think sometimes we can have an idea in our head of what we think people might need and how people want to receive that, but that can sometimes be clouded by our own personal experiences. And so by opening up this aperture and by hearing from as many people as possible, we were able to rigorously and scientifically say, this is a need, and this is how people want the support, and then let that drive forward. So we joke internally, data don't lie, and we let that really guide where we go. It also, from a policy perspective, has helped us build inroads with, you know, Capitol Hill, with the Department of Defense, because people know that if we're leaning in on an issue, we have data to back it. You know, we're not chasing shiny objects. We are really rigorously evaluating what we take on. And that, I think, has in some ways set us apart as an organization. But the lived experiences and that ground truth that we have from the advisory board and the heart really creates the authenticity that blends the, you know, the scientific research with that lived experience and human component. And that's really where our programs, in a lot of cases, are born and bring those things together in a way that meets a need, is collaborative, and resonates with people.
Yeah, not only shiny objects I'm hearing, but also sometimes money, attention tends to follow conversation. And I think it's really easy in DC for there to be a conversational shift, and a lot of the focus shifts just based off of conversation. So I love the fact that you guys have the data that backs up this is the actual need that's being presented. So when you described the beginning of this new venture around the time when you're meeting Rosemary, I'm guessing this is around 2013, 2014, mm-hmm. maybe. Okay. Yeah. And so you were in or coming into the military about that time. When I write it in the book, this was about the season when we're really tracking millennials are really coming into the force, or they've actually been in for a little while. Maybe they're still coming in. Some are maybe starting to take some more command roles. The oldest, maybe millennials are starting to do that. And so I talk a lot about this imprinting that happens as you have generations coming in during a very vulnerable time. I think this huge shift of a lifestyle from civilian to military makes a family very vulnerable. Some are leaving their family and friends or locations. And whether they're going OCONUS or CONUS, it can be a very vulnerable time, which creates this imprinting. Like everybody kind of remembers their first duty assignment, you know, where you're getting your ID card and figuring it out. And one of the things that I was really tracking over time was as millennials were coming in, there's a lot of other things happening at once. In that 2013-14 is where we have sequestration happening, budget cuts, that we're really starting to feel that on the ground. And our entire community was going online, where we're starting to vent a lot of our frustrations and concerns, jumping the traditional chain of command by going online and venting that. So all of that is happening as you're coming in. Did any of that influence your experience of the military during that time and then influence you to want to research some of those issues that you were seeing?
Yes. And I feel like if this were a song, it would be "It's All Coming Back to Me Now" by Celine Dion. It was a really, it was a challenging time. And I had some imposter syndrome, being a brand new military spouse, trying to get this organization off the ground and doing so alongside some people who really are giants, in this space. And it was hard. And there were a lot of things happening as it relates to, you know, keep your promise and protecting the commissary and the focus on the many brands of ketchup that were on commissary shelves. It was just, it was a pretty volatile time, I think, in the military family space. And there was a lot of working together that was happening among certain people to drive an issue forward. And in a lot of cases, I was excluded from that. And it was difficult. And at the same time, we were overseas. And so we were in Rota, Spain, and I was trying to figure out, like, what is it to be a military spouse? My husband was working crazy hours. And then I was finding myself excluded in a lot of cases from some of this work that I really was passionate about and wanted to play a role. And I'll never forget Rebecca Sanderlin called me one day when I was overseas and asked me how I was. And my immediate response was, "Oh, I'm great. You know, all's good. You know, drinking sangria." Like, and then she's like, "No, Shannon, how are you?" Mm-hmm. And like, that was the first time that I think I really gave myself the space to not put on this facade of being okay. And mm-hmm. in some cases I was getting picked on. I was intentionally being excluded from conversations, and that never feels good. It especially doesn't feel good.
Can you describe a little bit of why? What was going on as far as being picked on?
I was a newcomer, right? Mm-hmm. People didn't know me. And there was really this established group of very, very strong advocates in this space. Mm-hmm. And you know, MFAM is still figuring out who it was in the space, mm-hmm. what our mission was, and all those things. And so, you know, I don't think that there was really malintent there, but I wanted to be part of something that I was not welcomed to.
So this was part of the, let's say, the spouse or the nonprofit space that was really trying to make a difference. Because I know that there was also a lot going on, boots on the ground, for especially millennial spouses as they were coming into just generally the spouse space. There was a lot of spouse bullying that was happening online during that time. A lot of millennials were coming in and experiencing a largely disgruntled, highly anxious group of spouses that were going through those feeling, you know. I had Amy on Bashat's earlier, where she was part of that group that felt largely betrayed. You know, a lot of families are getting pink slips, or those promises were being broken. And so I think millennials were coming in as, especially spouses and family members, were feeling those broken promises, which I think imprinted on millennials this very negative experience. So on top of that, you're saying that here you are trying to make a difference in this space and also getting some of that pushback.
Yeah. And that, in a lot of reasons, in a lot of ways, that's what pushed me to the research side of things. And you know, how can I really prove you know, why I'm here. And if I have data to back things, you know, that in some cases is a little bit more, you know, indisputable than, you know, just Shannon, you know, and this group of people being there to do good. And so that was in some cases, you know, hindsight's 2020, like, you know, that was a little bit of the, you know, subconscious, I think, that was driving that, but it made a big difference for us in having something very concrete that we could let shape who we are as an organization.
I love this so much. And I think that's why you're a really great example of this kind of beacon of light that comes out of this volatile time, like you were describing. I know we talked before I hit record that you would consider yourself an older millennial. A lot of millennials really, everybody calls them, thankfully we're not calling them the snowflake generation anymore, but they're really more of the why generation of like, why asking, why are we doing things the way that we're doing? Why can't we do them differently? And also this courage to really advocate, take things to the top. And that's when we started seeing kind of this breaking of chain of command. Where would you fall into that drive as a millennial? You know, before millennials were coming in, I would say Gen X and boomers were really taught to go through your chain of command to change things. And I think that that was part of the frustration, is that if they felt like things weren't getting changed or weren't getting changed quick enough, we were just kind of told, wait, you know, it will eventually get there. Whereas I feel millennials came in and said, why do we have to wait this long? Yeah. So how do you fit into some of that?
I think I really kind of split down the middle in a lot of cases. And so, yes, I'm on the older side of millennials. I was also raised by parents who very much are, you follow rules, you listen to authority, you know, you don't ask why. Like, if I say you do something, you do it, Shannon. Yeah. And so that's my background, but then I'm surrounded by all these people who are challenging the status quo, are, you know, pushing the envelope. And I think that as MFAN and I have matured, I've gotten more comfortable in the asking the difficult questions. But I think it's always important to come at it from a perspective of respect. Mm-hmm. And respecting authority, and it's a lot of the how you're asking things, not necessarily what you're asking, mm-hmm. always. And I think that has in some cases been a differentiator in my leadership style. I'm not coming at things from an adversarial perspective. I'm coming at it with the mindset of, we're all trying to do good here, and let's give people the benefit of the doubt and remember that people are innately good and kind. And then, so how do we then share information and work together and ask some of these difficult questions so that we can see different sides of this, of a challenge? And so, you know, I think, you know, there's a benefit in all the things, and all things have worked different in different audiences, and also knowing how to read a room. You know, there are some places where, you know, I can have more of those, you know, straightforward conversations, and in other cases where I have to listen and then have a follow-on conversation. And I think that can be where some people have a misstep, is that you come at it so hard all the time, and that's admirable and that's great, but sometimes people just shut down. Yeah. And then you're not going to get anywhere with it. And so and that's a lot of where the mental health counseling background, you know, in some cases comes in, and just knowing how you have to adapt your approach depending on who you're having the conversation with.
Yeah, so good. So good. Okay, so when I talked with you, when I first sat down with you, we were talking food insecurity, and your research was coming out about that. As I was doing a little bit more research on MFAN, especially as I was looking at the timeline historically as I was writing the book, I really saw just how influential MFAN was in really putting the mold housing crisis on the map. So I'd love to hear your perspective. I would say you've kind of been put on the map twice. It was kind of like this, and then food insecurity on a whole different level. So You know, when I look at the timeline, I can see how budget cuts and sequestration and lack of funding really contributed to the lack of oversight that was happening on the installations with housing that later turned into a mold crisis in 2019. But share with everybody a little bit about your involvement with the mold crisis and exposing that and how that contributed to getting some of the attention that we now have on it.
Yeah, so it started with our advisory board. That's how also the food insecurity work started. So we have this ground truth. We have this constant ear to the ground and boots on the ground, all the things to the ground approach. But based on what we hear from the advisory board, we then test it through research. And so we want to know if what we're hearing are anecdotes or if there is something to it from a data perspective. And not to say that anecdotes don't matter, because they do. But we don't lean in on anecdotes. We really lean in when we have the data to back what we're looking at. And so we heard from an advisory board member, Kelly Artis, about challenges that she was hearing about with the quality of housing and just the lack of recourse when people were experiencing difficulty. And so we had the opportunity to field a survey. And within 1 week, we had 17,000 respondents. To the survey. Our minds were blown.
Which, just for perspective, that is huge compared to probably any other survey that had been done to date.
100%. And it was something, we struck a nerve at the right time.
Yeah.
And within our community, we know that when that happens, it could spread like wildfire. And that was very much what happened with this housing survey. And so not only do we field the survey, but our director of research, Shelley Kimball, and I, we spoke to over 100 military families at the same time that we were going through this. And so we were hearing the personal stories. We were hearing just, it's about more than mold. It's about what happens because of the mold. It is about more than having, you know, a single level house. It's okay, what happens to a family if they have a child with special needs who can't do stairs and they're in a multi-level house? And so we had the opportunity to put together this report that then made it into the hands of the Senate Armed Services Committee and really became the cornerstone for privatized housing reform. And I say that, and it sounds like it's done. It is not done. There is still a lot of work to do as it relates to housing, but it gave Congress something very solid to sink its teeth into so that we could really put a fine point on how significant the issue was. And having 17,000 respondents, you get to a point where you can't, again, data don't lie. You can't, you know, say that this isn't something. And so we then had the opportunity to be in several meetings and really work on influencing the Tenant Bill of Rights. And again, it's something that we continue to track through our research because it continues to evolve and the experiences continue to change. And the reality is the way that the partnerships happened within, you know, the Department of Defense and the privatized housing companies, they're 50-year contracts. And so we've got to figure out how to get to a point of this being able to work. Otherwise, you know, people are going to continue to struggle.
I just want to point out, you said 50-year contracts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's significant. That's significant. Okay.
It is. And it's, you know, it is a complex issue as it relates to everything from, you know, the appreciation of the property to what is the liability of assuming it. Okay, the Department of Defense owns the land, the housing companies own the buildings. And so it's a really complicated issue. And I think that one of the things that happened is there was a lot of attention here. And it was very important to fully understand what we were talking about before we, you know, really went into any conversation. And that in a lot of cases has been how I've just conducted myself. I've had, you know, I had a few experiences early on where I was in meetings and I didn't feel like I was fully prepared. And I didn't feel like I was as educated on a topic. And I vowed that I would not have that happen again. And so my confidence in a lot of cases comes when I know I'm one of the smartest people in the room on an issue and having the data to back it. If I don't have that, then the imposter syndrome for me continues to spin out. But that's been a lot of how we've built the trust also, is taking, you know, that approach.
I think that's so important and fantastic. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that I felt like there was a lot of conversations happening without full understanding of all the variables. And there's no way I can be an expert on all the variables, but I felt like if we could just inform people with enough information to understand the complexity of even just, you're right, like the mold in the housing, and seeing how that goes back all the way to like the 90s. I mean, people were even asking for things in the 80s too. And so understanding historically where we land on the timeline and all of these pieces and the privatized contracts and all of that, it's so much more difficult to understand, but also difficult to change. And with that information gives us maybe the patience and also the right information to advocate. Talk about for just a second what it means to be a change agent. We often think that the system investigates itself, you know, and the DoD does put out surveys of some kind, but here we have this influx of not just organizations advocating for change, but spouses that are creating organizations that are leading to change. Can we just talk about that dynamic for a second?
Yeah, it's complicated and not always been comfortable. And so what I mean by that is, in some cases, we were pushing, especially on the housing and food insecurity, we're pushing on some pretty difficult things that can, you know, really lead to people having to take a look in the mirror. And I remember when this was really, MFAM was first starting to, you know, have that first growth spurt around the housing, and just having to have conversations with my husband about, like, I've got to push on this. This is really important. How do you feel about that? Knowing that, you know, he, you know, this is his livelihood, this is his career. And, you know, and that's, again, where the data piece gives, in some cases, some cover. But it was hard. And, you know, we got more comfortable as a couple in it, you know, as issues push forward. But, you know, I remember him saying, like, Shannon, you're on CBS This Morning and Fox News and CNN, and I'm trying to, like, be at work. And, like, people are like, oh, your wife was just on TV again. And, you know, in some cases, you're talking about things that don't always make people look great. And so that was hard. At the same time, being part of this community and living these experiences makes it a lot more personal and makes it so just fulfilling. And I tell people that this work is more of a vocation than a job for me. And I believe that. And I believe that that's why, in a lot of cases, we have been successful, because it is personal to us and we really, really do care. And I work very hard to make sure that the care does not overshadow the data, the science. And so it's like, how do you lead with the right balance of head and heart? And that's been something that I've had to work on over the course of the last, you know, several years, especially as we uncover things that are heavy and are very personal for people. Like when, you know, a family's having a hard time putting food on the table, you know, you just want to help every single individual. That's great. We also have to keep the big picture in mind, and how do we do good for the most? And that can be a really difficult thing for people to, you know, come to terms with, especially as navigating the space as a national organization.
Well, and I think what you just said about leading with your head and your heart is such a great way to say that. And I think that's a mark of a good leader. Great leader is that you know how to try to find the balance in both. Doesn't mean that we find the balance every day in both, but it does mean that we make sure we include both. I think when we lean too heavily towards our head and forget our heart, we forget to bring that empathy. Right. Yeah. And if we don't have a strength for empathy, that's where I tell people, like, lean with curiosity then, right? But if we lean too heavily on that empathy, there's a great book that came out called The Fallacy of Empathy. And I think the military talked about that for a while, that if we lean too heavily on empathy, then we're not, we're kind of like thrown with the wind and we're going in whatever direction based off our emotions. And so I think the mark of a good leader really knows how to lead, like to your point, with information, with data, with truth, with discipline, with self-control, whatever that looks like, but pair that for a heart for people. In the end, we are leading people, right? And yes, we are, in your case, we're talking about taking care of the people that are doing the job. And I know you and I have a similar passion on that, of just how do we do well? How do we lead well? How do we work well, but be mindful of the fact that we're also leading people?
Mm-hmm. And you can't overlook that. And it's also very, when running a nonprofit, it's mission first, right? And I believe that. I believe that that can be difficult, but also how do you get to the point of fulfilling your mission? That's the people. And so it's really having these two really critical pieces in lockstep. And I think that you really hit on something in, you know, sometimes it can feel easier to follow something because it's what people are talking about or where the funding might be, or, but you have to stay true to who you are and to your mission. Yeah. And mission creep is really real. And I think that that, you know, people with the best intentions can fall victim to that if you don't really build in the time and the space to build strategic plans and, you know, review your mission with your board and those things that don't necessarily feel like the most fun and enjoyable, but if you don't do them, it can really like put you off track.
Can you share a little bit more about that? You know, I'm familiar with the term mission creep, just in case someone isn't out there. Maybe give some examples of maybe where MFAN maybe have been tempted with mission creep and what that's been like for you to try to stay on track. Because I think that happens for any leader, not just for nonprofits, not just for businesses, but even military leaders, as we go into each new assignment and you only have a couple of years, if you're lucky, to make a difference. Yeah. Mission creep is very real.
It is. And we have had, the clearest example that I can give is, had funders come to us with an idea of something that they want to institute in their head. And they say, MFAN, we will give you X amount of dollars to do Y. And sometimes we have to say this isn't the right fit for us. If we don't have the data to back it, and if we don't have our advisory board telling us the approach is something that, you know, is authentic and will resonate, we can't do it. That is contrary to our mission. And so in those situations, we try to steer people to something that is more tied to the data or an approach that we know will have a better chance of being successful. In some cases, that does not happen. And so it's, you know, our mutual friend, Michelle, says that's a hug and release situation. And so, and that can feel really difficult, especially at a time when, you know, funding is, you know, not as plentiful as it has been at other points. You know, it can feel really, you know, hard to say no. But at the same time, if you don't say no, and if you really kind of move away from what, you know, your mission really would point to, that's, I think, where people can really lose sight of how best to do business and again, stay true to your mission.
Well, and another thing that I think you have done very well is that you have surrounded yourself with a team that is not only knowledgeable, but very talented. You have PhD level researchers on your team. You've got an incredible advisory board that serves out specific terms. So you've really professionalized the data collection space in a way that I think no other organization, especially no other data collection, if I can call it that, organization has done. And so, and I believe a significant portion of your team are military spouses.
Thank you. Yeah. And I have a personal goal of always hiring people that are smarter than me and better at what they do than me in their area of expertise. And then I can be the strategy and the glue, but it has allowed us to really grow in a way that, you know, some younger organizations, we're still young, haven't been able to do as quickly or as efficiently. And so, yes, have an unbelievable team. And I also think it's really important to take your work seriously, but not yourself. And so removing ego, and that can be difficult. But we take a no ego approach, to how we do our work. And that allows us to be a lot more collaborative, as well. And at the end of the day, we subscribe to military families don't care who they get the support from. They care they get the support that they need. And that's something that we really, try to live by in all of this.
Can you share a little bit about, you guys are now leading the way as far as information on food insecurity. I'm here outside of Fort Cavazos. So I know that's one of the most food insecure locations. So talk a little bit about how that has evolved over the last several years. I know COVID was definitely a rough year, but the years since then, food insecurity is still a topic. And your results have gone all the way to the top, really, and have really led this discussion. So share that kind of next evolution that happened or is happening with MFAN.
Yeah, so again, we heard about food insecurity first from an advisory board member, Taylor Miller, another millennial, who was working down at a food bank in the Hampton Roads, Virginia area, and seeing a lot of military clients come in. We added questions in our survey around food insecurity, and we found, okay, this is actually an issue. We tested it again in another survey and used the USDA 6-item short form food security scale to make sure that we were using the best, you know, possible methodology to really understand this. We then brought to the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense had a very different way that they were looking at food insecurity, and they were looking at it from a perspective of SNAP enrollment. We know that most military families are not eligible for SNAP because of the basic allowance for housing. So we continue to bring this forward. We're continuing to hear that, no, we're barking up the wrong tree, or this is not a thing, or it's contrary to what the department's data was showing. But we knew it was an issue. And so we then had the incredible opportunity of doing some additional research to really uncover the why piece. What's happening in people's lives that bring them to the point of food insecurity? And so we interviewed more than 300 food insecure military families at Fort Cavazos, as well as the Norfolk, Virginia area, to help us uncover the causal factors that lead to food insecurity. At the same time, so while we're working on understanding this, we know that military families can't wait in a lot of cases for, you know, additional research or policy change. And so how do we become that stopgap and continue to inform the policy that's required to really create the long-term sustainable solutions? And so we had the opportunity to work with Nora O'Donnell in CBS Evening News, and she did a three-part story on food insecurity. And that led to a windfall of support that enabled the launching of the Million Meals Challenge. And so between 2020 and 2021, we distributed, or maybe 21, 22, those years are all messy in my head. We distributed over 1.5 million meals to food insecure families in the locations where the data showed had the highest frequency of food insecurity. So Fort Cavazos, Fort Liberty, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and the Norfolk, Virginia area. At the same time, we're continuing to advise both from a Department of Defense and also on the Hill perspective. That's advise is a key word for us, and not advocate. It allows us to really work very well with both the Hill and DOD. And they then changed their methodology. They implemented the scale in their research efforts and found that it was very consistent with what we were finding. And their data was 24% at that point in time. And so we're really, this shouldn't be an issue. Food insecurity should not be an issue that people are struggling with. However, I think if had we not taken that data first approach, I don't know that we would have changed the dialogue and the focus that we have changed.
Changed it, I think, as quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Because usually the way that works is you present an issue, and then maybe Congress, you know, if the DOD doesn't do the work to find the data, then Congress is charging the DOD to go and find that data. Now we're talking years down the road. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what's fascinating with so many, especially spouses who've jumped in to say, we'll fill that gap so that we can see change happen faster. How do we build out these nonprofits or these ways ahead to speed the process up, which I think, coming from a Gen X perspective, I think is fascinating. Yeah. It sounds very normal because it's just what we know. But I think when you step back and look at our long history of how the military and military families have traditionally gotten things done, I think it's been fascinating to see, especially since 2008 to maybe 2010, how millennials really have driven change and sped up the process of getting information to the right people and inspiring or influencing those changes to happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I cannot speak enough to how strong and brave military spouses are. And I think that this community especially, and it came through full force with the housing issues. You know, there is not only the mindset of taking care of our own, you know, nuclear family, but also knowing that if I'm struggling with this, how can I make it better for everyone else? There's likely someone who's experiencing this at a more severe level. And also, how can I make it better for people who will follow? And I really think that that gets back to the patriotic, you know, calling and service focus that we all really believe in. And I think that the millennial group has, you know, pushed and continues to push, and really having that, you know, North Star being this is what right looks like. Mm-hmm. And how do I really take care of my family and the people who will follow?
There's actually two divides that I actually would love to hear you address. One, you just mentioned that getting on this this news program just brought in this windfall of support. And so what I hear behind that is it really started to close this divide with America. America could finally see some of the issues that was going on, is going on within the military. And so share some of the lessons learned, some of the wisdom that you have about the civilian military divide. We're seeing that, I don't want to say now more than ever. I'm just saying, even I have noticed, even in the last 6 months, this growing divide, or maybe I can call it growing lack of awareness, really. And so share some of the wisdom that you have figured out in getting Americans to see those issues and get involved. What do you feel like can help close that divide better and bring more awareness?
I think it's when you marry the data and the personal emotional story component is really when you're able to get attention. And I don't think that having one, I don't think you have one without the other and really drive change. And that's where our model has been so successful, because we have the data and we also have the advisory board members in their network who are very connected and willing to help us get in touch with people who have those compelling stories that, you know, are willing to share them. So I think that that is a big piece of it. And then the other piece that I think is just important for us all to remember and how we address this gap is remembering the military is a microcosm of the broader population. And I think that if we always keep that in our head, it will help us not isolate ourselves in some cases from the broader population. So food insecurity, for example, you know, the military community is not alone in experiencing food insecurity. Yes, there are nuances that make it more complicated. However, how can we look outside of ourselves to figure out where there are solutions and how we can adapt those to really work smarter, not harder? And I also think that in a lot of cases, military spouses don't first identify as a military spouse. You might identify yourself as a mom, as, you know, an employee of a company, as a spouse, and then, oh yeah, and my spouse happens to serve in the military. And I think that that is a shift that has happened over time, especially as we move more and more to dual income households, for example, and just a shift in what command and what those experiences look like. And, you know, I think there are pros and cons of that. I think in some cases that has, you know, that perpetuated things like the issues with mold and housing. You know, people weren't coming together in people's homes as much, you know, 70% are living off installation. So just the landscape has changed. And how do we make sure that we don't try to deploy the same solutions based on what worked in the past,
yes,
but that we're always adapting and learning and testing and optimizing. So
one of the things I hear you saying is be careful to not further isolate ourselves and make the gap worse, which I think I was surprised in the research that I was doing to realize that the military is actually the one that started that gap to begin with. And I feel like I was raised in a generation that implied that it was the civilian population that contributes to it or whatever. And I think that opened my eyes to realize the influence that we actually have in staying connected and not isolating ourselves and not making it a position against another, right? That there's a lot of, and I think that also helped me as I listened to civilians to understand their perspective of the military, instead of pushing that perspective away as if you don't understand, to actually truly listen and be curious, because there are some things that I heard civilians say that informed me on their perspective that was really hard to hear, but important to hear. So that's one of the things that I hear you saying, is not making that worse. And I agree with you. I do think that the younger generations are changing where they're living, how they're staying involved, and that can be a really great thing. Instead of seeing it as a threat to the traditions that we've always had or the ways that we've done things, that we can actually lean into the positives of that and bringing the community back together with the installation.
It's in a lot of cases, it's, you know, history repeats itself. And I think about the new ideas that are coming into the fold now, and what my experience was having new ideas back 10 years ago and how that felt to be blocked out. I think it's really important that we listen. I think it's really important that there is room for everybody at the table. And I also realized that, you know, being a millennial, I'm not part of, you know, MFAN's target audience as much anymore. You know, we're really thinking, how do we get to the 21, 22 year olds who are, you know, in some cases experiencing the most challenges. And so not having the perspective that because this has worked in the past, this is what we're going to keep doing. It's, we have to keep challenging ourselves, and we've done that. We've invested in that. And I think that that's what gives an organization longevity. And, you know, that can be difficult for nonprofits to have an experience.
To be willing to evolve if needed. Yeah. We're almost out of time. I want to bring up the second divide that you that you've brought up and that MFAN has researched, in that you found that there was a significant difference in obvious quality of life, but also experience of the military between officer families and enlisted. Because it's really hard to have empathy and make changes if you're not going through what someone else is. So maybe speak to what you guys found on that and the importance of listening to both sides.
It's a huge point, and it's something that our experiences personally, I think, can cloud our understanding, right? And again, that's where we hearken back to the data. The data clearly show that, you know, it is the junior enlisted with children who are experiencing food insecurity at, you know, the highest frequency. It is the junior enlisted and even middle enlisted who are living in base housing that are seeing the longer wait times for issues to be fixed. And these are really important pieces to know, and important for us to make sure that we don't lose sight of. One of the things that I'm proudest about our research is our representation of the junior and middle enlisted. We are an overlay of the, you know, what the force demographics look like. And that's something that is really important. And I think in some places you hear more from one voice than another, and it can skew things a bit. And so, you know, there's not a one size fits all experience. And I think that one of the things that we have challenged others to look at is, how do we make sure that we are thinking about how we support military families in the broader context of what America looks like today, and what it takes for a family to thrive and be successful? Not just looking at, oh, well, this median income is comparative to this median income with a similar education level. No, that is looking at it without taking the whole context. Okay, if a spouse isn't employed, what does that mean? If they can't access childcare, if you don't have a network of support, and really looking at what it means to serve in the military for the whole family, and how do we make sure that we are understanding and supporting that in a way where there doesn't create a rub between, you know, putting your family first and serving. And I think that that is something that we're really trying to work hard to make sure is always at the forefront. How can service and supporting and loving both your family and service coexist together? Because that is critical for, you know, readiness and really preservation of all volunteer force.
Well, when I lead leaders and I put a graph up on the screen, that's 88% of the force is millennials and Gen Z. Like, that's a good reminder to the Gen X, especially leaders, like, we're outnumbered. It's important to remember that that's who we serve, right? While I was writing the book, I came across a lot of articles, interestingly, written by civilians. That surprised me, kind of speaking of the civilian-military divide, that I had to kind of stop and actually listen to, and it was kind of hard to hear it. Ever since the end of, or the beginning of the all-volunteer force, a lot of stuff was coming out saying that the military was another welfare state. Mm-hmm. That we have, to your point, the food insecurity, the struggles that you're seeing in some of the data, where on the outside, especially when our country is looking at how do we fund and take care of those that are in the social welfare state, is the military a welfare state as well? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that, again, the military is a microcosm of the broader population. I also think that, yes, some are struggling and some are thriving. And it's important for us to look at both sides of every data point, mm-hmm, and understand what's working and what's maybe not working, and not stick with something that's not working just because it's something that we've invested in. And mm-hmm. So I do think that we have to look at the full picture a lot more in how we compensate and support those who serve in the military, and do so against the backdrop of what it is to thrive economically in our country. And I think that in some cases, those things have not kept up, especially when you layer in things like military spouse unemployment and some of those challenges that have been perpetual over the course of the last 15 years. And so I think there's a lot of work to do. I am encouraged by the steps that have been taken. I think that the administration and the Taking Care of People initiatives have moved the needle. I think there's still a long way to go. But that's where, in a lot of cases, it's the nonprofits who can lean in, and where I'm focused is how do we create a scalable proof of concept that can then become the future, right? Yeah. And that's really where we are leaning in right now. So we've done all this research. We know that in a lot of cases, it's not a question of if the resources that people need exist, it's if people are plugged into the resources through ways that they want to be plugged into them. And so, I think that we got to get to a place of better public-private collaboration. Mm-hmm. I think the Department of Veteran Affairs has done a better job of this than the Department of Defense. And we've got to remember to always take ego out of it, and mm-hmm. That people are genuinely trying to do good.
Yeah. So, such a difficult question and such a great answer on that. Shannon, do you want to quickly share a little bit of what MFAN is doing and where MFAN is going?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll be releasing data in June. And so we just closed our survey in December. We had an incredible response rate. And so we're really, really excited about that. We'll also be hosting our Solution Summit immediately on the heels. And so what we do is we don't want to sit on data. We don't want, our reports to just sit on a shelf. And so we bring together stakeholders from the public and private sector, as well as our advisory board and alumni, to say, okay, this is what the data is showing. What do we do about it? And how do we do so with the right people in the room to drive the right solutions? And so that's coming up for us. We also just launched this program pilot at Fort Cavazos, which is designed to get at the causal factors that lead to food insecurity. And so when families are arriving at Fort Cavazos now, they have the opportunity to get a pantry starter kit, which is all the things that you have to get rid of every time that you move. Mm-hmm. About $150 worth of everything from shelf-stable items to shower curtains. And so we're really excited about that. But that is just the start of this. We are now integrating a component with Instacart. So families who are participating in this program and screen as food insecure can get access to healthy groceries delivered to their home for 3 months following a move. And so again, how do we bring the right partners together to create that 1+1=3? And that's something that we're really focused on as an organization and look forward to sharing more in the upcoming months.
I love that so much. I mean, I can't imagine anybody listening who would not agree that $150 worth of like just the starter, just to get going is not only meeting a need, but it's a morale booster. And so thank you so much for what you're doing in that. Shannon, thank you so much for how you channeled your passion and your talents and your love for people in a direction that has influenced the masses, really. And that is the ideal, I think, of any leader is that how do you maximize and multiply your talents? And so thank you for what you've done. You've been an incredible role model, I think, for a lot of people. And I'm really proud to have watched what you guys have accomplished and what you guys are rolling out with now. And I've worked with your team. They're fantastic. You're, like you said, extremely smart people who are helping you do those great things. So thank you for joining me.
All right. Thanks for having me. And thank you for sharing these stories. I think it's really important that we learn from each other. So thank you.
I look around these streets. It's funny, nothing really changed. 25 this week and everybody's still the same. Still hate police, still fighting racists, still wearing masks to cover up our faces. Still looking for answers that we're never gonna find. Still stuck in the past because the present blinds. And still selfish, only think about what's mine. I wish we gave a little back to the kids, but still, this world keeps spinning. And still, it's never ending. And still, on grinning, and still, it's all gonna be hard still. There's people dying, and still, there's children crying, and still.
As a Gen X, I wish I could say that it was my generation that was the hero generation. Sure, there have been plenty of Gen X that have impacted humanity for good, but for most of our generation, our independent spirits were solidified in the crucible of our latchkey upbringing. We lived a Survivor series before it was ever a TV show. Millennials, however, swung the opposite direction, away from independence, and instead invited our multi-generational nation into a giant family meeting. With their signature question, why, they have challenged us to talk about the many elephants in the room, making all of us a little or a lot uncomfortable. Many, like Shannon, have made it their purpose in life to not only pick up the baton, but to turn the ship. In one of my favorite TED Talks, Derek Sivers shared that a leader is not as important to change as the first follower. Using footage of a lone half-naked man dancing at a music festival, he pointed out that the true movement only happens because of the first follower, as one, two, and then a whole crowd joined in on the dance party with the lone dancing man. In Sivers' words, it transformed the lone nut into a leader. This proves that anyone can want to be a leader, but lasting change requires that there's someone in the room willing to see potential and perhaps the lone voice on the other side of the room that just might be challenging the conversation. You never know if that conversation is the spark to something big.
Look around these streets, it's funny, nothing really changed. Still chasing dreams I'm probably never gonna taste. Still pick these strings, but they just never feel the same as the days with my homies in the basing. I ain't never been the type for the money and fame. I'd rather teach my kids to appreciate this moment while it's here, cause in 25 years all these problems gonna still be here and still.
The Military Culture Shifts podcast is sponsored by New Res and written and produced by me, author, speaker, and military clinical consultant, Corey Weathers. The closing credits song is Still, written, produced, and performed by active duty service member Tyler Smith. This is a supplemental leadership podcast for the book Military Culture Shift, The Impact of War, Money, and Generational Perspective on Morale, Retention, and Leadership. Copies of the book can be purchased on Amazon, militaryfamilybooks.com, and your favorite retailers. More information, including graphs, data, and other resources mentioned in the book, can be found on my website, coreyweathers.com.
can make a better life. Instead of complaining about what we become, we teach our children how to fight for what is right. Our differences don't define the type, and Jesus might still love people that don't believe in Jesus Christ. So while you sit behind computer screens and type, remember whatever you say better be relevant outside. From black lives to abortion, gay pride to the borders, our differences are enormous, but we bleed the same in our wars.